everyone. Welcome to episode 2 of Game Day Glare. I'm Lance, and this is
E in the place to be.
And today we're going to talk about essential gear for videography.
Yes. Should we remind people, since this is only the second episode, what this show is actually about?
Yeah. So why don't you tell us what it's about, E?
It's about me, basically. No, it's about sports videography. We're both professional sports videographers. And we talk about the industry, our jobs, how to get in, what to do, how to do it. And specifically today, what equipment you should be using while doing it.
There's a lot of choices, right? But I guess let's start with cameras and lenses. So what setup are you currently using right now, E, when you go and shoot sports?
My main camera, I'm a Sony person, and not because I'm that type of guy that's like, oh, I'm only this or I'm only that and everything else is crap. Like, this is so not me. But I used to be Canon, actually, and then there was a flood in my office. I lost everything, and then I started from scratch and decided to go with Sony, which we can go into later, the reasons why. But I have a Sony FX3 as my main camera, which I'm very happy with. I think ideally I would love to have internal NDs in my camera and not have to deal with that. But other than that, this is the ideal camera for me. And then I have a Sony FX30, which is basically the same thing, but with a crop sensor. So that's my second camera. So in case something happens to the main one, or if I need a second, second angle, which these days is mostly just to film behind the scenes stuff, while I'm working and I'm using the behind the scene content for my YouTube channel. But these are my two sort of go tos. I have a little ZV-E10 that I bought to do a review years ago, and then just keep just in case. But that's about it.
All right. So I'm currently shooting on an A7 IV. I did have an A7 III for a while. That camera was a killer. I love that camera. Fortunately, something happened to it. I don't have it anymore, so now I have an A7 IV. Reason I have the A7 IV is for hybrid. It's the pixels on it for shooting photos are great, 33 megapixel, compared to the FX3 or the A7S III, which is only 12 megapixel. There are some drawbacks, but I use them to my advantage. So when I'm filming hockey, if I do 4K 60, it's a crop sensor. So I'll use a 2875 Tamron that I have, and it enhances it. So it gets me a little closer to the action. So I don't mind the crop on that. And I'm usually shooting at like either a wide open at f2.8, or I'll shoot at f4. I also have two GoPros that I use quite often. I actually use them for a lot of like crowd shots or unique stuff. Like I'll stick it behind the net for goalie angles, or I'll stick it in the penalty box. Sometimes I get some penalty box shots, or I'll reverse it to the crowd behind the penalty box. And basically those are just my safe ones. Sometimes I'll even clip it behind the bench to get reactions when they score goals. So what I try and do is like, you know, when you're shooting something by yourself,
so what do you use? I try like and get a myself clamp as many or angles. A suction cup, or like, how does it?
Yeah, it's a little suction cup that sticks to the glass. I bought a small rig one. I'm a really big fan of all the small rig products. Like, I got a cage and everything I buy, I always make sure it's small rig. Handles, all small rig. And I also have a DJI Mini 3 Pro drone that I use. But I use it more for, like, establishing shots. I've flown it over a couple arenas and a couple of rinks, but it's scary. It's scary, scary, scary flying that indoors because there's no GPS. Yeah. You always got a big crowd. There's always someone watching you. And, you try some interesting shots, but you come close to that scoreboard sometimes, or close to some obstacles, or even actually one time I clipped a wire in the air that I didn't see. And my drone was okay after, but it was pretty scary. So that's what I got going on right now in my camera bag. But I also use a broadcast camera for all the Habs games, right? Yeah. So that's Sony broadcast camera. And we have a Canon lens with that.
Okay. And with the A7 IV, like, do you have any overheating issues with it? Because there's no fan in it.
One time I did, but I was in an extremely, extremely hot room. The only issue, the camera does get hot, but, you know, in the settings, I turn off the I put the heat to max, but you have to have your viewfinder opened. Like what happened when we were filming, Ian and I were filming the other day. He was testing a camera and overheated because the viewfinder was closed. But except for that, no, I filmed like 4K 60 for like 3 hours straight, and I've had no heating issues at all.
Okay.
Well, I do get the warning.
But never shuts down.
Never shuts down.
That was my main reason. Well, no, there's other reasons, but with the FX cameras, it's like, yeah, there's a fan in there, so I can shoot 4K 120 and never have to worry about, yeah. Because I've been testing the A6700 lately, and overheating has definitely been a challenge. It's been interesting. So I just feel like you're always sort of, you know, every time there's a break, you're turning off the camera. And then even then, like I went to film the other day, and it was like during the fourth quarter, it was basically camera would turn off, then I turn it back. The good thing is that when you turn it back on, it actually keeps going. But it's like you turn it off, then it shuts off, and then you turn it back on, then film for like a minute and a half, 2 minutes, then it dies again, and then you turn it back on, and then dies again a minute later. And it's like that back and forth until there's maybe like a timeout when you can turn it off and just allow it a bit more time to cool off. But like, yeah, it's just, man, it's a lot to deal with.
unneeded stress. That's what that is. Unneeded
exactly. Stress. Well, especially you're doing this usually, like for me, it's like a basketball, for example, and it happens always towards the end. So it's like, it's the fourth quarter. That's when, you know, you want to be filming the baskets. That's when it matters. And so that's the last time that you want to be dealing with that stuff. I'm very comfortable with my FX cameras, mostly for that reason.
But you said you were filming at 4K 120, right?
Yeah.
You always film at 120? Like, I find sometimes 120 is an overkill. Like 60, I can get away with it. Slowing it down to 40% for me, I like it. But 120, yeah, it's extra creamy, I find. But do you feel like you need that 120?
Well, need is probably a strong word, but yeah, I just get used to it. I think once I started doing it, and then you have that flexibility of being able to go that slow, and then it's all about the speed ramping, really. It's like trying to make those, you know, quick to slow sort of transitions like as cool as possible. So obviously being able to go as slow as like 20% speed just makes it a bit more, you know, punchy. And so yeah, once you get used to having that option, it's hard to go back. But at the same time, when I do film at 4K 60, the last game I filmed was with the A6700, so I did film at 4K 60 the entire time, and it's fine. Like, you can definitely do some very creative like speed ramping, but yeah, because I have the option, I'd say 95% of the time when I'm filming a sporting event, like an actual game, I'm at 4K 120. But sometimes it does, if I use it like mostly, because sometimes I end up, you know, not slowing down much, and it's all at you know, full speed, and you know, 120 at full speed sometimes can look a bit like jittery, and it's not like as smooth and as crisp as it would be if I filmed it at 24 frames or 60. So sometimes I sort of regret my choice, but
So I've been doing the opposite. Lately, I've been filming a lot in just 24 frame. Because with reels and that and highlights, I find my videos have been fast, you know, like fast pace. You want a quick cuts, quick that. So I've been shooting at 24 for that. Now, yes, you can slow it down in post, and it's not as good as if I added more frames to it. But honestly, the files are a bit lighter. Yeah, and I like definitely. It. It's what it is, you know? And I don't always do it. Don't get me wrong. Like, if I need like warm up shots or nice shots of close ups of guys, I'm shooting in slow mo for sure. Or a higher frame rate. But for game action lately, I've been shooting at 24, and honestly online, I've been seeing a lot of guys have been doing that. You ever do that or no, never, ever?
Not really, to be honest. I can't remember the last time I filmed sport action at 24 frames per second. It's been a while. last time was probably 25 frames a second when I was still in Australia. So, because it's in PAL over there. But yeah, no, it's been a long time. Obviously, if I'm shooting like an interview or something like a sit down thing, like I'm definitely going to be shooting at 24. But yeah, but you're right though. I should probably go, because for me, I think when I'm filming, especially these days, because I'm doing all this YouTube stuff, a lot of my content is repurposed. So maybe I'm shooting for one reason, but then in a few weeks or maybe in a few years, like I'll reuse that for something else. So having that flexibility, that's the same reason why I shoot in S-Log 3. Like it's not necessarily because I want to be, you know, getting like the maximum dynamic range and doing all this color grade in post. Like no one loves to do color grade. Like I should, like filming in S Cinetone would be much easier. But since I don't know, maybe I'll end up mixing this footage with footage with from somewhere else in a future YouTube video, having the flexibility of having the frame rate, you know, the playing it at the speed that I want and grading it the way that I want sort of helps me with that. So, and also even when I was working with clients, honestly, because like a lot of the clients that I used to have in Australia, for example, like I used to do like all the videos for the Australian soccer team, and you know, it's once every 3 months or whatever. So you're using a lot of older content and things in hype reels, but in other types of videos. So like, there's not that many games, so you're reusing content from the same games over and over. And so yeah, having that flexibility to be able to use it sometimes in full speed, sometimes in slow-mo, just being able to use it in all these different ways is really helpful.
I think that's a good plan for longevity of your stuff, like you were saying. Because honestly, if I have a fast project to turn around, like, or I'm doing highlights for my son or whoever, if I have a fast turnaround, then I'll shoot in Cinetone, and yeah, I'll shoot the sports highlights in 24. But for you, who's repurposing it later on, or for people who are trying to build a portfolio, then that's a great example of what you said. Like, if you have the time, film an S-Log and get the extra frames, you might as well, right? But I mean, if it's something that's going to be fast and it's going to live once, then hey, why not? Why not save yourself the time?
Yeah, no, exactly. And actually, I've done it like a couple of times where if I'm just filming and then giving the raw sort of content to the client, depending on who the client is, like if they don't really know like grading and all that stuff, I'm just going to give them like S Cinetone stuff. And I'm just going to probably film at 60 frames, because that way I can export it at 60 frames, because exporting at 120, first of all, well, actually, I either give them the raw files, but like ideally, like what happens with these types of clients is I just put like a reel of all the best sort of content and just send them that. So 60 frames is much better, because like a 120, like you can't really create a 120 sequence in Premiere or any other. Like you can, but there's a bit of a workaround and stuff. And yeah, and it creates huge files, and then it's a bit complicated. So definitely for short turnarounds or like specific projects that you're filming for one thing and it's just going to be that, then yeah, I would simplify. Well, that's what's great about these cameras, like whether it's the A7IV or the FX3, you've got picture profiles that have a lot of dynamic range that can be either like in camera, and even when you're filming in S-Log3, like you can actually import a LUT and embed that LUT in camera. So like, I don't do it, but like with my S-Log3 footage, if I wanted like that conversion LUT that I use in post, like I could just embed it on my footage in camera, so that when I ingest the footage in my Premiere software, like it's already back to like a Rec 709 look. I don't do it, but yeah, there's ways to really like speed up process.
Only on the cinema line, like mine on the A7IV, I only have gamma assist unless I use a ninja.
Yeah.
So, but it is a good option to have that, right? Like just to see what it looks like.
Yeah, now, no, true.
Now that everyone kind of knows we're both Sony guys, right? The only, honestly, Canon, I never really used Canon cameras, but I do like their colors. I do like their color science.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the reason why people do like Canon. It's the color.
Yeah.
Well, Sony's getting there, but they're not there yet.
Because like Sony is like the new sort of cool kid in town. Like people don't realize, like, I don't know, I want to say maybe 5-6 years ago, like Sony wasn't even near what they are today. Like it's just because even like this A7 III was probably their first sort of camera that really caught people's attention in terms of like, you know, being bought like in huge numbers and everybody had one and stuff like before that. And even the A7 III, like the colors are a bit, yeah. And the colors are a bit sort of, there's a lot of like, you know, you can easily, like the reds, I think, are the main issue with that camera. Like it turns like magenta really quickly and it's a, you know, there's a bit of work, like, and if you're going to film in S-Log, then there's definitely a lot of work involved, like where Canon, you know, if you go back to like the cameras that they had 5 years ago when that camera came out, like you would film in C-Log and you would just add like a little conversion LUT and everything would look great. Like you said, the colors are like, they're spot on. And obviously in terms of like photography and lenses and all that stuff, like Canon's been in that world for way longer than Sony. And, but it's just that Canon, for me personally, like I love Canon cameras, but it's just that when they started introducing the RF lenses, and it's at that time that I had the flood in my office and had to buy new cameras. And it's like, I was going to buy a new camera anyway, because my cameras at the time didn't do 4K or anything like that. So it's time for a change. But it was like, if normally you kind of stick with one or the other because you already have all the batteries, you have all the lenses. So it makes sense to just buy a camera that's going to fit all that and not have to restart everything. But at that point it was like, if I buy a new Canon camera, now these RF cameras, they have different batteries and they have different lenses. So really going with Canon was, there was no advantage going with Canon over Sony. And I was like, at least with Sony, first of all, there's like, you know,
Sony's ecosystem stays the same. The batteries,
yeah, exactly.
The lenses, the mount.
And there's hundreds of lenses. And if the Sony lenses are too expensive, there's Tamron's, there's Sigma's, there's all these other brands, there's third party brand that make an E-mount like lens, where with the RF, the Canon EF was the same way, but with RF, they're not selling that license to anyone. So the Canon's the only one doing it. So first of all, there's not that many lenses. Well, now there's a few more, but back then there wasn't that many to choose from. They were super expensive. And it's like, well, you know, I want to create a new kit. Now I'm going to have to buy all these super expensive lenses. And I know you can use a converter and just use EF lenses, but like, what's the point at that level of quality? Like if you're going to buy those like fancy cameras, you want to maximize their potential and not sort of ruin it with converters and stuff. So I was like, at least with Sony, you know, I can buy like, there's a lot of options at different price points for lenses, and that's their main. When I met with a Sony rep, like she was saying herself, like that's their main thing. Every time they have a meeting, it's all they talk about, the one mount that fits everything. And then at least like as a kid, you're buying your lens, it's worth like investing a little bit more money because that lens is going to last you forever. It's going to fit every other camera that you buy after that. And lenses don't lose quality. Like it's not like obviously there's better ones that come out, you know, in the future, but like a lens is always going to be a good lens. It's not like it's going to lose anything over time. So yeah, for me, Sony, it was mostly a budget thing, but Sony made a lot of sense. And they also like their cameras and their lenses are much better than what they used to be.
For me in broadcast, I've always had a Sony camera, but we've always had Canon lenses. All the lenses are Canon, but the cameras are all Sony. I have no idea why, but it really helped. Like when I've used many Sony cameras, like from, I don't know, FX6, FS5, FS7, all that. Yes, the only thing is the Sony menus are not fun. The menus are, they're not user friendly. They're getting better now with the newer versions, but even
the last ones are. The last one's all right. I like the fact
that
there's like a summary. And
the FX3 and the A6700, the newer ones, to even mine, the A7S3 or the A7IV, they're different menus already because people have been complaining about those menus. Hmm. But I find Sony is very, very reliable. Not that Canon isn't. It's just for me, I've just always trusted it, and it's always been great cameras. Even like, look at you and I used to use EX1s, EX3s. I never had any problems with those cameras at all. They were workhorses, and I think that's what Sony does have going for them. Maybe it's because of that broadcast background, but definitely Canon always has had the advantage in lenses. Yeah. So speaking of lenses, what's your go-to lens?
Depends what I'm filming. Obviously. I think, if I'm outdoors, where I'll probably need a lot of range, I'm almost always on my 70-200 Sony G Master f/2.8. That's the Mark II as well. So it's as far as I'm concerned, the best sort of the sharpest and most reliable sort of sports videography and photography lens. But if I'm filming indoors, then it's a bit more, it's a bit harder because it's if you're filming basketball, it's way too tight. You need something a bit wider. So I tend to go with my Tamron 35-150 f/2-2.8. So it's very sharp as well. It's much heavier though, so it can be annoying, and there's no stabilization in that one. So these are my two sort of main ones. I have a few other ones, but and also the other thing I like in the Sony G Master is the fact that I don't know what's it called. You know, I like the autofocus. You can have you can block out 3 meter to infinity, like something like that. Like it's either gonna focus on anything or it's gonna start from 3 meter onwards. So when you're filming sports, if you're filming something behind a net. You pick the focal length. Yeah, well, that thing is it's not going to, sometimes you're filming behind a net or you're filming at hockey, you're filming behind the glass. Sometimes it'll focus on the glass or on the net and you're going to lose a lot of, or if you're filming MMA, you're trying to film through the cage or boxing, the ropes and by turning that switch on, it's never going to focus on these things. So it's always super clean on the action. And that saves you a lot of trouble. But those are my two main ones. But when I started though my Sony kit and I didn't have that much money, I was definitely into the Tamron Trinity that most people have used, which is a Tamron 17-28 f/2.8 and then the 28-75 and the 70-180, if I'm not mistaken. So the first one, the 17-28, was more for establishing shots. But the other two, I use a lot for indoors, one for indoors, one for outdoors. And I still have my 28-75, actually. I sold the other one, but the 70-180. But that's pretty much me. What about you?
So actually, it's funny because I have the Tamron family that you just mentioned. But my 28-75 is the newer version, the G2. And I had the G1 also. The G2 is a lot sharper.
Yeah, I heard.
It focuses a lot
stabilized,
faster,
isn't it? Is it stabilized?
No. None of them are. There's a bit. The cameras are getting better, right? The lenses, you're not going to have stabilization in a lens unless you're paying top dollar for it. Yeah. Not everybody has a G Master like you. The G Master line is great, though. I've used a lot of those lenses when working with other people and that. I definitely think the Sony lenses are really, really great, but affordability to have on your own, they're a lot. When your lens is double the price of your camera sometimes, so I'd rather go with the Tamron family. For broadcast, like I said, I use a Canon. It's a 7mm to 190mm, but it's a 25 zoom and it's full servo. But that lens for my broadcast camera, that lens alone is 5 pounds.
Yeah.
It's a big, heavy lens. You said, the Tamron, your Tamron 35-150.
150.
That's a heavy lens.
Yeah. Yeah,
compared to 28-75, it's probably a good pound and a half heavier than that lens. Because your camera is kind of top heavy after, I find, if you don't have the V-mount battery and all that on it.
It is by far the heaviest lens I've ever filmed with.
Yeah,
for sure.
But the advantage I find too of having the Tamron family is they're all the same thread for filters and that. Yeah. And I know you're supposed to get a ring, and you're supposed to get a bigger filter for all your lenses. Stuff, but me personally, I don't like the look of it. And it's nice having a filter that's meant for that camera.
Yeah. Well, the other problem with step-up rings is that you've got the filter screwed into the step-up ring and then the step-up ring screwed into the lens. So when you're trying to separate all these things, like sometimes, yeah, they get stuck together and it's annoying and you need to grab it from the inside or something. So if you're at home, you know, putting your stuff away, it's not that big of a deal. But when you're at a game and you're trying to do this quickly and not touch the actual glass so that you don't have to clean it afterward and all that stuff, yeah, it gets messy and annoying.
Polar Pro just came out with new filters that have built-in magnetic step-up rings, the hex, and they just snap right on. Now, they look great, but they're all meant, they all come in the biggest size, but coming in the biggest size comes with the biggest price.
Yeah.
So there's pros and cons, but the speed for it, I think the speed is worth it. I think that's what makes it. If you're really running and gunning and you need to slap on that ND filter fast, it's a really, really good option. It's just they're pricey at over $300 a lens.
But like when you talk about like the G Master being expensive, like it definitely is. But for me, it was like, because it was at the time where I was about to move from Australia to here. So obviously I'm trying to get rid of a lot of stuff. And also I'm like, I don't want to be carrying a tripod anymore. So at games, I mean, like, just don't want to film. Like I'm handheld all day, every day. So I figured if I buy a lens that has stabilization in it, that way I can probably get away, because I've got stabilization in my camera as well. I can probably get away with never using a tripod ever again, unless I'm filming like an interview or something. So that was sort of my reasoning. Plus, so basically I don't need to buy a tripod or a good one. I've got like a small shitty one, but not a great one. I can sell my Tamron 70 to 180. So if you take these things into consideration, then yeah, that
it was a good means investment that the other,
yeah. So yeah, the money sort of, you know, it offsets a bit of the costs and then it's worth it because it makes my life way easier.
Okay. So speaking of stabilization, what stabilizer equipment do you have or would you bring to a shoot?
Well,
or you try to bring
watching
anything?
This in 16:9, you can see a gimbal behind me, but I'm not a gimbal guy at all. Not that I don't like him, but again, I just don't have the patience. Just like the tripod, I don't like carrying a lot of stuff. I just want to be like, you know, walking around, doing my thing, filming when I don't want to be setting up and having like tons of stuff in my backpack and having a case and all that. Especially when you're filming in places where you don't know really where you're going. Like, well, I have like a dedicated access to like a dedicated like photographer and videographer room where I can leave like my expensive stuff. And so when you don't know these things, like I don't like to bring like a lot of stuff. So, for stabilization, I use what's in my camera and my lens really. Like I do have a gimbal, but I use it only for like specific shoots. Like for example, if we're doing like a media day, then I'll definitely use a gimbal to make my shots a lot more creative, a lot more dynamic. Other than that, yeah, establishing shots maybe, but like if I'm going to a game, honestly, I probably should, but I'm not going to bring my gimbal just to do like four or five establishing shots. Like, but that's just me, you know, freelancing and doing mostly shoots for myself. Like if I was working for a client or if I was working with a team, then I probably will have my second camera on a gimbal so that I can shoot, do all my things like normally. But then when I need a gimbal shot, I would just grab the other one that's already on it, do my gimbal thing, and then just put it back and keep going with my main camera. That would be how I'd do it. But
so I am guilty
part of my job
of what you said. I bring my, I have the Ronin RS3. No. I bring it everywhere I go. I regret bringing it everywhere I go because it's another piece of equipment that sits in your bag. So then I find myself trying to make myself use it. I'm like, you know what? I need this nice entrance shot or I need this nice shot. So basically I'll set up that shot, but ideally you want your second camera on that. So you can just put it down, grab it as you need, and have another camera ready to do handheld. I'm very big on handheld too. it is hard with the stabilization. I wish like these cameras had a little bit more stabilization. When I do the broadcast stuff, it's all handheld I do. And it's so stable, my camera. It's so stable, my lens. But it comes at a premium price. The lens of my camera is $45,000.
But you could rig your mirrorless camera and with like a shoulder mount thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, you could. You could. I never tried it because we had an FS7 for a while. And that was kind of the setup. And it was the most uncomfortable camera I ever used. Even the FS7. It's uncomfortable, like when you're kind of wedged in and you're too high.
Yeah. So
I felt like those cameras never really worked. Like even the FX6, it's big. Like you're holding it out here and it's like, it doesn't feel the same. Like our little Sony cameras, A7IV, FX3, I find they're really, really good. I mean, yeah. You know, you kind of bring it close to your body and you're a little compressed and you're making sure you're turning your body, not your arms. Mm-hmm. But I find that I feel more stable with that than I would with a bigger camera. Now my shoulder camera. And the FX6
doesn't have stabilization actually.
So no, it doesn't. It has ND filters, but it doesn't have stabilization.
Yeah. That was my main thing. Like I was like, when I bought the FX3, I was debating between those two. Obviously, FX6 is much more expensive, so that was also an argument. But one had ND filters, the other one had stabilization. And I was like, which one is more important to me? And I went with stabilization, probably because my camera beforehand didn't have any stabilization and had ND filters. So I took the ND filters for granted, and I was really looking forward to getting some stabilization. So I was like, I'm going with the FX3.
Actually, the worst camera I ever used for stabilization was a Red. I used a Red camera. I've never used a Red camera. I used a Red camera for this Scooby-Doo documentary. We were filming in 8K.
Yikes.
And they, you know, we're working on the final edit, and they realized like, oh, we don't have a shot of the outside of the building, and we need a couple B-roll shots. So I run outside fast to go and get this thing, this establishing shot. I had to bring this massive tripod. I had to bring all this gear because I tried to do it handheld. Yeah. First of all, the camera was so awkward and the footage was so shaky and so crappy that I was like, you know what? We're doing a tripod. I'm doing this properly. But I thought I could just run out fast, get the one shot I need, the establishing shot of the door and the building. Forget it. It was awful. It looked like there was an earthquake. Like, first of all, with the cinema lenses, it didn't help. There's zero stabilization in them.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was the same thing for me. Like when you're that's what annoyed me about not having stabilization in cameras, that sometimes you just want to do like a quick establishing shot and it looks all right when you're filming it. But then when you're looking at it on your computer, you always see that little jitter, that little shake. It's not big, but it's there, and it's an establishing shot of a building. Like there shouldn't be any, unless you're going to do like a smooth movement, like there shouldn't be any. And it's like, yeah, it just annoyed me. And so to be able now to do these shots without a tripod is just saving so much time.
That's where the gimbal comes in handy, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's what you want the gimbal for. But the issue I have with my gimbal, and I don't know if you have this issue, it doesn't always do what I want when I want it to do it. Like, you know, you're moving and you're trying to do this. You're like, okay, I want the shot to come in and I'm going to pan left. And then you're going and it starts moving on its own a bit. And I find I'm fighting with it sometimes. It's not as smooth as they make it sound.
Yeah, no, definitely. And honestly, for me, it's like, if all I want to do is like a slow sort of, you know, movement from left to right or a slow push in, I'm just going to do it in post. Like it's going to be exactly what I need it to be. It's going to look exactly the same. It's like, why would I bother? Yeah, it's just easier. But
when you show up with your gimbal, you look pro. It's like having a matte box on our Sonys.
Yeah, there's no point. Exactly.
But everybody suits them up because when you get that high paying client and they see that matte box, they think it's worth it.
Yeah.
So, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. But then there's situations where, if you're, I don't want to say overcharging, but like if you're charging a lot of money, like you need to look the part, because otherwise the clients get a bit insecure, especially if you're like a small team or you're by yourself and they're like, what are we paying for exactly? So, but if you have like big gear and everything looks like impressive and very, you know, cinematographic, then they're all like, they feel secure, they feel safe and they're happy with what's going on. But I'm sort of the other way most of the time. Like I'm filming either behind the scenes or I'm around like athletes, I'm around the field, things like that. So I don't want to get people too worried, especially if they don't know who I am. So like a small camera, people don't really pay you much attention. Where if you have a big kid, then like, sorry, who are you filming for? Why are you here? Like, can I see your credentials? All that stuff. So it's like, yeah, I'd rather sort of just be a fly on the wall with my little camera and do my thing and not be bothered by anyone. What camera would you like if you were starting now?
Yeah.
And you were hoping to like maybe eventually, you know, do maybe not work for the Canadians, but do a little like paid work, like little jobs here and there, either for teams or for players and stuff. Like, what would you say would be the ideal camera or camera kit to start with?
Budget wise, obviously it all comes down to your budget, but I think the FX30 is a great camera. Yes, it's a crop sensor. You can use full frame lenses on it, but I think just the fact that you can do 4K 120, 4K 60, no overheating issues. You don't even have to buy a cage. You could plug a handle in it. You know, you can also get the top handle that comes with it too for XLR mics. I think it's a really, really great option for sports. But nowadays, even it's going to sound crazy, but if I didn't have the money to start off the camera and I want to start filming, iPhone 15 Pro, yeah. I would use that to start.
Yeah, it's surprising.
And most people have it in their pocket.
Yeah.
And I've been guilty of it. So like I help out my son's team and I'll do highlights and that. And I don't always bring my camera gear with me. And in his season edits and stuff like that, I'll throw in a couple iPhone shots. Yeah. No one knows the difference. Now, yeah. I don't film the whole video in iPhone, but I definitely think it's a good starting point and it's a cheap starting point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's you know, it's obviously there's limitations to what you can do with iPhone footage, but yeah, sometimes, especially if you're not, because the thing is, like, you can't zoom. So like, if you're trying to zoom in like on phone footage, it's gonna, you know, the quality is gonna go down like very quickly. But as long as you keep like the lenses to the focal length that they're meant to be at, like there's two or three, but even like if you go to the longer ones, the telephoto ones, like already right there, like that one has less quality than the others. But yeah, if you stick to the prime sort of specs of the phone, you can actually get some good content. So if you can get close to the action, that can definitely do the trick. If you're at the top of the stands filming and hoping to do like a great hype reel, that's another story. But
yeah, too far. You have to be close to the action. But you know what's crazy about the iPhones is the stabilization in them.
Yeah.
Like even GoPro, like action cameras. Why can't they put some of that action camera technology in our SLRs? Because like my GoPro is so stable. Like it's impressive.
Yeah,
like
it's really impressive. But it's a much smaller sensor though. I'm guessing, I'm not like a gearhead, but I'm guessing that the bigger the sensor, the bigger everything else around it has to be. And then
exactly.
Becomes,
it's like when you have
expensive.
A zoom lens and you're zoomed in, every shake is multiplied, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what would you start? Yeah. What do you recommend starting with?
Well, I've always on my YouTube channel, like my go-to every time someone would ask me, like, what's the, you know, budget sort of camera for starting an up-and-coming sports videographer. My response was always the Sony ZV-E10 because I thought
it's a great
like
camera.
It's I think now it's like $600, well, US, but and yeah, it does. You know, you can do like 1080 120p. It does everything you need it to be. It's not obviously not gonna look as great as my FX3, but definitely good enough in the right conditions. If you expose properly, you can. I used it a few times as my second camera, and people wouldn't have noticed the difference because I used it in a way that was maximizing his strength and not, you know, putting it in the situation where it would look bad. But yeah, that's usually my go-to. But yeah, if you got a little bit more money, then the FX30 is definitely is definitely better, like, as you can shoot in 10-bit, you have like dual native ISO, you got stabilization, you've got all these things that are making a big difference. But yeah, it is more money and it is a steeper learning curve to learn how all these things work. Cause that's the other thing, is like it's one thing to buy an FX30, but if you don't know how to, if you don't want to, cause that's a lot of people to think that the solution is the equipment and that just by having better equipment, they're automatically going to get better footage. But to get the better footage with the better camera, you need to learn how to expose properly. You need to learn how to color correct. You need to, and there's more work that comes with a better camera as well. It's not like, you know, with other things in life, like usually the more money you spend, the less work you have to do. But with a camera, it's pretty much the other way around. Like the better camera means more work as a videographer because you need to shoot in manual mode really to sort of make the most of all these features. And then you need to either color grade or do something in post. Like it's rarely just straight out of camera, everything's perfect. So it depends on how much work you're willing to put in and where you want to go with this. Like if you just want something auto that's just easy to handle, user friendly sort of thing, then yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is, you're better to stick with like a ZV-E10 or A6400 and just sort of have fun with it than to spend more money into something that you're not really going to make the most of all the extra stuff. You know?
The thing that I find makes the biggest difference too is lighting. And it's, yeah, with the cheaper cameras, it's light sensitivity, you know? It's like, yeah, how soon are you getting that grain in your shot that kind of makes it not look so good? You know, so that's why you're paying the bigger bucks for the full sensor, right? But it's sure, honestly, lighting is key. Like, I mean, I've filmed with good cameras in shitty lighting conditions, and it looked not very good. So, lighting is key. Lighting is key, and even in your edits, like, right, lighting and audio, yeah, they make up so much of the image. It's not even funny. Like, you know, it's not just about, yeah, the camera; it's about everything else that goes with it.
Yeah, and I love using audio to tell a story and to add more sort of, you know, make my videos look more action packed with a good sound effects or just the audio that I actually recorded.
What audio equipment are you using now?
On my camera, I use a shotgun mic, an XLR shotgun mic, because that's the other thing as well that I like about the FX3 is that there's XLR inputs. So I use the Deity S-Mic 2S, I think is the actual model name. Yeah, I like it because it's very good quality, especially for like run and gun stuff. And it's also very short. So because a lot of those shotgun mics, like at that level of quality, they tend to be like quite longer, like the Rode ones. They're probably double the length, maybe not double, but almost. And so if you add like a dead cat on top of that, sometimes if you're filming wide, like you can actually see the tip of your shotgun mic in the shot. So that's annoying, obviously. So having a shorter one, like, just guarantees that that's never going to happen. So I like it for that as well. And it's easier as well when I'm vlogging, I can just sort of turn the camera around and shoot myself with a wide lens and it's all good. But yeah, I'm definitely into XLR shotgun microphones. I also have like a DJI mic wireless kit. I really like that as well. If I'm doing like interviews or if I'm miking someone, stuff like that, I love the fact that there's an internal recording as well. Cause the drawback with whether it's the DJI or the Rode, like they're cheaper. So it's not like professional wireless kits. So if someone's far away and there's people like in between us, or if they turn their back to you, sometimes you lose the connection a bit. So having that internal recording that you can always go back to just in case, that's definitely a lifesaver. And also having the safe track, like you can record to a certain level that you think is right, but just to make sure, you can double up into another track that's recorded like 6 dBs lower. So that's always also very helpful in sports, because, you know, when they talk at a certain level, but when they celebrate or when they scream at someone else, it's definitely a much higher. So having the safe track is very helpful for that. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
How about you? So like you, I have the same DJI kit I use for a lot of interviews. I usually hook it up with a lapel. On my camera, I have a Rode Video 2 mic. It's a small one. I got it because it's compact, and I like that it has, it's self-powered. You plug it into the audio jack on the camera, and you don't have to worry about batteries.
Yeah, I think I have it, actually. I just never use it.
But yeah, it's pretty decent. But actually, nowadays, all the craze is about 32-bit audio. So yeah. Where are you on that? Have you tried any of these new DJI mics or the new Rode system that has 32-bit float? Because that would solve all the problems of how you just said, when you have a player mic'd up and they're celebrating. Now, have you tried any of that? Have looked into any of that? Is something you're thinking of getting?
I haven't, no. But yeah, it is like you said. I think that the purpose of that is that you can basically push up the audio in post as much as you want or lower it it won't clip. Like it won't you won't bring in more noise by pushing up, or like you can, if it's clipping, you can actually turn it down and you'll lose the clipping. Like it there's an enormous amount of like dynamic range in the audio that's recorded. So obviously very helpful for mic up videos. No, I haven't tried it, to be honest. I think I tried it once, but I'm trying to remember. Cause I remember, I think someone sent me footage that was recorded with that, but yeah, it is really helpful. But I've heard, cause that's in the newest version of the
DJI and the Rode wireless too. Yeah. Wireless. Yeah.
But I heard there was stories of people having like connection issues and like a background noise or something while they're using the DJI with certain cameras and things like that. And I heard it was sort of the same thing with these, new versions of it. But I don't know.
Because there was frequency issues, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Having that flexibility to not clip, that's a game changer, like not to worry. Because I'm constantly monitoring my audio levels. Like I'm lowering them down on the camera also all the time, checking, making sure everything's good. You do your sound check with somebody and all of a sudden they go off and you're like, oh no, did that clip? It'd be nice to get rid of that little headache, you know?
Yeah. Well, the way I'm set up, like with my shotgun mic, even if I'm not using the DJI with the safe track, because the XLR inputs, I can record whatever I'm recording in channel one, because there's two inputs, I can double up in channel two. So what I usually do is like one, I do that, and then one channel, I have it like set manually to what I think is right. And then on the other channel, I'll leave it on auto. So that way, when someone is screaming, it'll probably prevent it from clipping on the audio track, on the auto track. So I sort of have a fail safe that way, but then you have to remember every time you use your audio in post to just, you know, use one of the tracks and not just assume that one and two are just like left and right, because they're going to sound different. And normally I try to use always the one that I set manually, because the audio, what happens is that when everything, you know, every time it's a bit lower, it pushes it up. So there's more like background noise and things like that. So I only use it like if I absolutely have to, but yeah, it's sort of fail safe.
I love the fact that they come with backup channels. Cause it saved me. Interview, I had an issue with the actual receiver itself froze during the interview. But you're in mid conversation, you know what it's like. Sometimes you have a guy for 5 minutes, so you can't even really say anything. So I just went off the internal recording after. Now I knew it was still recording. Well, I was praying it was still recording.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was okay with it. But now, have you ever just clipped that DJI mic onto somebody and use that for an interview fast when you're kind of running around talking to players?
Not really for an interview. I usually, like when I've done interviews with players in the last few years, it was always off a shotgun microphone that would be like attached on the stand and just, you know, on top, usually at a media day, just because at a media day, it's just so much easier to have that shotgun microphone, you know, there, and they just take their mic and ready to go and not have to, you know, mic each player one after the other, like, oh, can you go under the jersey and oh, let me help you and all that sort of stuff. Like if you can avoid that and just have the shotgun always at the same spot, it's just so much easier. So for interviews, I haven't done it. I use my wireless mic more for like mic'd up videos, like mic'ing up like a player. I'll have like a you know, those like vests that you wear underneath. Like now these days, like players always, it looks like a sports bra. And usually it's to wear like a GPS tracker so that they can tell like the speeds that you're going to and all that sort of stuff. But I use it, basically I replace in that little pocket where you would put the GPS tracker, I put my DJI mic and then I pass a lapel sort of to the front. I clip that to the front and yeah, they go that way. Which is great because that way, because the pocket's always at the back, and so that way it's people think that it's actually not a good thing that it's gonna break, but like there's a reason why the GPS pocket is at the back.
Yeah, because that's less there.
Exactly. Even when you fall on your back, it's, you know, the spine is arched, so it's the middle of the back that takes the impact, and the top of the back rarely gets hit at all. So so that's where the microphone is. So the chances of it breaking, there's always a chance obviously, but they're very slim. But the lapel microphone that I use, though, I definitely use a cheap one just in case, because even in basketball there's one that that broke, I think, just from contact from, you know, guys boxing out and stuff. So and also there's a lot of sweat that goes in there, so you don't want it to you know. But yeah, no, that's more mic'd up videos are mostly what I do with my my lapels and wireless kits.
So I had to I usually do the same thing. I'm doing now a sit down interview. I'll try and have a boom mic over the head if I can, because that's just the easiest, especially when you have you know, two or three people to interview in the same spot. They're walking in, yeah, walking out. You just give it a quick sound check, you're good to go. I was in a situation where I had to go on the ice one day for interviews with Hockey Canada. It was U18 National Championships, and it was like, hey, run on the ice. They're handing out the trophy. Grab the top players, grab the coaches, and go. Now, I'm with somebody who's asking the questions, but you don't really have a microphone. Well, Rode has one now where you can actually pass it to people and kind of do the traditional mm-hmm. interview style. So what I did is I took the DJI mic, and I just clipped it on their jersey. But no one wants to see that DJI logo, right? So I asked Hockey Canada. I got a sticker. And I stuck that Hockey Canada sticker on it. So it just looked like they had a maple leaf. And they already had their medal on. So I would clip it to the medal, and it would look like it was a Hockey Canada logo on their medal. Smart. And it worked out good. And no one even from Hockey Canada knew that I had done that. I only told them after. I'm like, no, that's the microphone. Because they're like, oh, what's that Hockey Canada logo? I'm like, that's the microphone. But it worked out great in that situation. But honestly, I got lucky that we just thought of it like that. Like I was like, you know, how am I going to do this? I'm just going to clip it on, because you don't have time to help people up when you're running and gunning, you know?
Yeah. And even like, well, for that with players, like especially like you said, when you're running around, it's not ideal. But the DJI comes with like this little, it's like a magnet thing. So you could potentially put the microphone inside and just have the magnet sort of showing, which is like super small. It'd just be like a little black thing. And I've done that a couple times actually.
Did you do that on your YouTube myself. Channel?
Yeah, exactly. Did I mention I have a YouTube channel?
Yes, you have. All right, next on the agenda. For interviews, since we're talking about interviews, mm-hmm. what do you do for lighting? Ideally, if you can control the situation, you will. Mm. But maybe let's talk about how you would control the situation and when you can't control the situation.
If I can control, I'll have a key light, which for me is like a Godox UL150. There's one right there. Yeah, so they're good because I like them because there's no fan, so they don't make any extra noise, and they're really bright as well. So that's going to be my key light. Otherwise, those little you know, red and blue lights behind me, obviously you can do like daylight, you can do all these different settings. So they're cool because they're, you know, battery powered, so you can bring a few of those, and they're magnetic as well, so you can put them easily like somewhere to help you with a bit of light if you need to. But if you're gonna do, and also they're great obviously if you're doing like you know, media day hype reel content and you want to add colors like I have in the background, but
or they die like mine.
Yeah, I was gonna say like we do, but I looked at your shot. I was like, I don't think you have any at the moment.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
See, that's why you need Godox. Godox, reach out to me. I'm a big fan.
I have Nanlight, and they're pretty good. But I guess maybe I had the power up too little, too high, so it didn't last the whole hour.
Yeah, Mine's on like 5%.
Oh, okay.
Which is what's good about these things. Like, yeah, 5%, it looks like this. So imagine at 100. But yeah, otherwise, if I don't have control on the light, first of all, that's why I like a camera with good dynamic range like the FX3, because it allows you to manage these things a bit better. But I try to just use the you know, daylight to my advantage. So if we're outside, first of all, it's like positioning yourself in a way that you're going to make the most of. You don't want the sun to, first of all, be in the subject's eyes while they're talking, and the whole time they're squinting, they're doing this. That's not great. But also, you don't want a too harsh of a light. So if you do have like something like there's these things you can buy like for $20 on Amazon. They're like reflectors, but like it's like a 5-in-1. So it can be a reflector, but it also can be just that white sort of see-through, texture thing, so that you use it as a, basically to sort of, it's like an ND filter for the sun, really. And it just gives a softer sort of look on your subject. So you can do that if you're
using it as a bounce, basically.
Well, I would either, because sometimes, like, if I'm, let's say someone's sitting in like stands or something, and there's a bit of we're in the shade basically, so that they're not dying in the sun while giving this interview, then I'll definitely use the reflector as a bounce so that the person is not directly in the sun, but then the sun is bouncing off this and going to their face, and then you don't need any lights, you're good to go. But if I'm actually in the sun, I'll use it more as a diffuser. That's the word I was looking for. So like basically I'll have the sun sort of coming towards them, but then the diffuser is up, either held by someone or by a C-stand if you have one. And yeah, just diffuses the light and makes it much, because otherwise it's very harsh on the face, and you get those raccoon eyes as well, where like the shade from your, so yeah, it doesn't look great. But if we're indoors, it's just trying to face a window and having that light in front and not behind you, and, you know, making the most of the room and finding a way that, yeah, you can use the daylight from the windows to your advantage. But if you don't need the light from the windows, if you have your own lights, then it's the other way around, trying to get rid of the windows altogether and just control the light so that it stays the exact same. Because the problem with the light coming from a window is that you never know when a cloud's going to come by and then just change your lighting, and it's going to go up and down. And yeah, that's a problem. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
All right. What about you? For me, if I'm doing an interview, I'm doing a 3-point lighting setup, key light, fill light, backlight. I always have my key light basically like at a 45, and my camera is closest to the key light, and I have the subject looking at me, which is a little off cam. For outside, I always try and make sure that the sun is behind me. Have my subject placed like at a 45, and the same thing, I'll use a bounce, something to make it a little softer, the light. And definitely you need an ND filter. But I try to find like a shaded area, which, you know, so everyone's more comfortable. But like, honestly, shooting outside is difficult, especially like, you know, they're in the middle of a sentence and a big cloud comes over and you're like, oh man, the whole dynamic just changed, you know? So I do try to avoid shooting outside if I can. And I really like controlling the light itself. For my lights, I have like a Godox SL60W, but I've been testing the Zhiyang, I call it, Molus 100. The light, actually, I have it right here. It's on me right now. It's the size of an iPhone. It's great for your camera bag. It runs, it has a grip battery. The battery is so-so, it only lasts about 40 minutes. But plugged in, it's great. And it's 100 watt. So I'm slowly upgrading all those to all those lights just because of the size, because it's easy to travel with. Like the Godox one is good, but I don't like the fact that like right now you can't hear it, but there's a little fan. So when you're doing interviews, you know, I got to mess around with the sound a little bit more, where this other light is silent. So that's what I use. But lighting is key. Like, lighting makes your videos so much better, but it's hard. It's tricky. Like, you gotta work on lighting and really have the time to master it. And I think that's the thing that took me the longest.
Well, since you're a hockey guy, because the most difficult part with hockey is the fact that there's so much light, sort of like the ice looks so bright often in comparison to the players, who will look much darker. So like, how do you expose properly? Because often your camera will, you know, give you all these, will tell you that you're overexposed because the ice is like super white, but at the same time, the players don't really look that bright. So how do you know when you're exposing properly?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. So it's like when you're setting your white balance, you got to make sure you're on. And actually, I always underexpose a little bit just because I'd rather be a little underexposed than overexposed, especially because a lot of rinks aren't evenly lit. Like, I'm talking amateur rinks. NHL rinks are pretty, pretty good. I mean, at the Bell Center, we've added so many lights. It's very, very even now. But it's bright, man. It's brighter than being outside in at noon. You know, it's bright in there. But so if I'm going to my local rink here to film, I'll underexpose by maybe one stop, just to be safe. Now, some people might say no, but if you're filming in 10-bit S-log, you're okay.
Yeah, you're fine. That's the key. Yeah.
That's the
to
key.
Me, it's like I'll try to like the ice. Like I try to see if I'm losing any details, because that's the, you know, white is white. So it's hard to tell, like, am I too white or like, but if you can tell that, like, oh, I can't see that there's a puddle of snow there in real life, but then in my camera, it's just everything is white and I can't actually see the difference in the texture of the snow, then I'm definitely overexposed. Right.
So exactly. I'd rather be underexposed than overexposed, especially with white background, with white ice.
Yeah. Because you don't want it to be all washed out. Like, you want to see those details, the texture in the ice and stuff like that.
Exactly, exactly. And make sure it has to be a manual mode. You can't have any of the settings change. You set an auto, like, even on my camera, I have a setting where I can go into my automatic white balance and I'll lock it fast for quick reference for running and gunning. But in the rink, no, you have to make sure you just lock that that white balance and manual mode. Make sure you get the right white balance and then keep it, make sure it stays the same. Cause if it changes, all your footage is you're color correcting for days.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
no, definitely.
So is that all the gear we've gone through, E? Is there anything else that we're forgetting?
I don't know. We're probably better wrap things up. Cause I think we've been going for
almost an hour. What camera bag are you using?
I don't know, actually. I don't know the brand. It's right there. This bad boy. Is there a name? I don't even know how to pronounce this. Wandrd. Wandrd.
And what? It's 25 liter? 35 liter?
Not sure. I'm not very good with... like, don't ask me how big my house is. I have no idea. But... No, it's good. I like it because there's pockets. There's a sort of a harder shell in the middle where you would put like the camera and stuff. There's pockets specifically for lenses, and you can open from the top or from the bottom if you want to go pick up something in that shell. Like, you don't have to open the whole thing. So no, it's really good for that. And there's a laptop sort of pocket as well. It's perfect for my needs. But I also have like a what's the name of that case that I have that's very popular? Like, it's a Canadian thing, I think. Is it Nanook or something? Like
Nanook, yeah. You have the hard case.
Yeah. Whoa, jeez. Yeah, I've got one. I got that too. I mostly got that when I was moving from Australia to put like my lenses and stuff. But if I do go somewhere where I know that I'll have access to like a photographer room or something, I'll definitely bring it and just put all my stuff in it. So yeah, these are my two sort of go-tos. But like I said, like I like to travel light. I hate like bringing stuff that I'm not going to use. And I'm like that, like in my everyday life. Like, for me, my biggest pet peeve is like carrying something in my pockets all day that I'm never actually going to use. Like, I've got like my house key and my car key. I don't have a wallet. I don't have like anything. Like, that's me. So I sort of tend to be that way with everything.
So I'm not like you. I have the 35 liter Peter McKinnon bag, and when E saw it, he thought I was moving out of my house because it's big, but everything fits in there. I honestly, it's one of my favorite purchases. Now, I will say I did not pay full price for it, thank God, because it is pricey. Ooh. But quality-wise, I love it. It's great. Like, I've had some other Manfrotto bags, or I had this Von Guard bag for a while that was pretty decent. But honestly, my Nomadic Peter McKinnon 35-liter bag, everything fits in there. I can bring all my gear, well, whatever I really, really need. I'm constantly taking stuff in and taking stuff out. But I love it. Honestly, it's a great, great bag. And I really feel like once you have a solid bag and you trust it, you trust your gear in it, it's nice. It's a nice feeling. So I'm very, very happy with that bag. Is it for everybody? No, just because of the price. But I think if it was cheaper, more people would definitely, definitely have it.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, like, because I often, like, my camera kit is just already together as I leave my house. Like, I don't want to put everything sort of like my camera, my lens, and all that sort of stuff in the bag, and then having to show up to the shoot and then put everything together. There's an audio end all to connect, all that sort of stuff. So, and the V mount and all these things. So I just do that at home and just have my camera actually has a seat in my car with this seat belt on and everything. And it just, that's how
I got a question around. For you. Do you have the camera sacks? Have you seen that? It's
no,
the sack
yeah.
that people wear. That's what you need. You put that in your car and that's your camera's seat.
Yeah.
I would be interested to try that though. I think that would be pretty good for stabilization, the sacks.
I know a couple of people use them. They're pretty good, yeah, for that reason. You can still have that handheld sort of look and feel of, like, you know, you can have those smooth movements and stuff, but the camera is rested on something, so there's none of that jitter of the hands getting tired or anything like that. So it's the perfect sort of, you know, halfway between handheld and gimbal. Like the bigger, so the next step, more like documentary style version of that, is the Easy Rig, where you have that sort of thing that's like, it's almost like shoulder pads, and there's this stick that's over.
I never
you
used that.
Like a cord. Have you ever and used the cameras it? Attached to it. I've never used it myself. I've been on several shoots where people were using it, but it's the same thing. It's like, if you're gonna, if it's more for like documentary sort of, you know, shooters. Like, if you're gonna be running and gunning, but you want to always sort of be all those movement to be smooth and not have any sort of harsh sort of shakes or jitters and things like that, it's great. But I don't know.
I've never seen anyone use
a robot, basically.
With a small Sony camera, though. I've only seen it with like FX6s and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, usually, yeah, if you're going to put that much money in stabilization, you've put more money in your camera beforehand.
Do you remember, E and I used to work with a guy, Gilles, who was with Steadicam. Remember his setup? Like, he had it was a serious rig.
Yeah, back in those days. Well, Easy Rig camera is like the newer sort of more, you know, like user-friendly version of what Steadicams used to be. Yeah.
Man, he had weights on him. He had everything. He was dead at the end of the day, but pulled off some beautiful shots. But the Steadicam system back then, that was it was next level. Like, no one has that anymore.
Well, I don't know if they still, I think they still do. Like, in Australia, all the sports that would go like rugby, that it just goes up and down all the time. The Steadicam version that they would have would be like, you know, those segways, those things that, so the guy's on the segway with the camera and he's just sort of rocking, you know, he's always going this way or that way. And he's on the segway thing. And it's like, and he obviously knows what he's doing, so he's never falling, but it's like, it's one of those things where there's like probably three guys in Australia that can do that. So these guys are making shitloads of money because they're just, you know, there's only them. It's not like there's a school showing you how to film in a Segway.
Did you ever see the clip of the Segway that runs over Usain Bolt?
Yeah. It's exactly that. Yeah.
I always think of that when I think of a Segway. The fastest guy in the world got run over by a Segway.
Yeah. Well, at least with them, like with the sports, it's soccer, it's rugby. Like, there's never going to be a player sort of, well, I guess soccer they could, but like the chances of a player sort of running out and hitting you are much lower than American football for example. But I've never seen actually the guy fall or get hit or hitting someone, but
No, I've just seen that one clip. Poor Usain Bolt, in the wrong place, wrong time. Yeah. So that's
should we do the Q&A?
Yeah, sure. That's about it for equipment. So now we'll go to Q&A, and hopefully we covered everything. If there's anything that you know you guys want to know, just write in the comments below on one of our platforms, and hopefully we can answer your questions. All right, let's start with the Q&A.
Yes. So one question that we did get. All right, well, let's start with this. When filming football, do you film handheld or do you use a tripod? And if you do film handheld, how do you hold your camera to prevent shaky footage? I think I touched on that already. Like, I don't use a tripod. And my way to prevent that is by spending a lot of money in stabilization. But yeah, no, I do the stabilization in my camera, the stabilization in my lens. So obviously that's a big step up. But I did do a video recently that explains exactly how I shoot handheld without shaking. It's all about the way you position yourself, like having your elbows tucked in next to your body, being, you know, not super wide with your legs, but wide enough so that basically all your camera movements are done with your body, with your hips, and not, you don't want to be lifting your feet. You don't want to be moving your hands. You just want to be moving your body. And yeah, that's pretty much how I film every sport, including football. What about you?
So for me, if I'm filming football, I'm going to use a monopod.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a monopod with a fluid head. Only because ideally I want to be on the sidelines for highlight shots, right? So I try and hang out with the – I'm talking, by the way, American football.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to hang out with the guys who do the sticks if I can for like, you know, I'm not, if I can, I'm on the sidelines, you're by the guy with the sticks. I'm not always using that monopod, but I definitely will use it sometimes. And if I'm not using it, I'll just put it all the way up and I'll have it as an extra handle.
I was going to say, have you ever used a hi-hat? Like a lot, I see a lot of people, especially at football, these old tripods that are like super low. It's like a fluid head, like all the, you know, everything that you would have on a normal tripod, but it's like this much off the, well, try to be in
charge. Off the ground?
Probably like this much off the ground. So you get those sort of.
Yeah. You know, so you could do that with your monopod, because your monopod, the one I have, it goes like, I think a foot and a half. It's a Manfrotto one.
Okay.
And you have like the claw feet on the bottom, right? So it's very stable and you have a fluid head. And honestly, I'll loosen the head where I can just not even use the handle. I just use the grip of the camera and I'll move it like that. Yeah. And I used to use it for hockey sometimes, but I found, depending where I am in the corner, when I'm getting the guy coming down the boards, I didn't like it because I needed more of a freedom. I mean, needed more freedom.
Yeah. Football,
I find because you have more space, the guy's running towards you a lot of the times, as long as you don't get hit. Right, because when you're on the sidelines, there's chances of getting hit. But no, I use a monopod if I can. All right, next question.
Do you know any good events or ways to network and get jobs in the industry?
So you can volunteer, which is not always easy, but you can volunteer. And like we said last episode too, minor sports, help out a minor sports team. Like, so where we are in Montreal, I do hockey. I would go to a Quebec major junior team or a midget triple A team, or even like we're talking about football, I would find a CJIP and I'd donate some time, do some reels for them, show them some highlights, because it's becoming more and more in demand. So once people know you, they'll call you again, especially if they like your stuff, and you can get more jobs because a lot of this is word of mouth, honestly. Yeah. And I mean, you got to show them your work. Somehow you got to get in front of them. So by maybe volunteering, doing one or two games, it helps your demo. It helps you meet people. It gives you good practice. I mean, that's the advice I would give. What about you?
Oh, I agree. And I don't know if that person meant, you know, by event, like actual networking events. But I think for sports videographers, a networking event is a game, really. That's it's just showing up to games where, like you said, lower levels, whatever you can get access to and show your talents and make connections and tag all these people in your IG reels and all that sort of stuff. That's how you network, especially these days. Social media is the way to do it, but also like meeting people and actually like introducing yourself and having conversations with all these people, whether it's coaches or other videographers. Like someone will refer you, someone will hire you, someone will recommend you. Like that's how it works. And the next question is sort of similar. Like, do you think that sport videography is a saturated market, or is there room for a beginner? Like for me, there's no such thing as a saturated. Well, there is, but I mean, like every market's saturated. Like it's just a matter of like being good at what you do and doing like what we just described. Like it just, it's not like, it's never going to be a point where you say like, nah, stop trying. It's not worth it. Like it's always worth it. There's always a way.
Yeah. And especially nowadays with all the social media platforms, people want highlights. And you know what? We might have the same goal or same home run, whatever, but you could have a different angle. I could have a different angle. My edit's different than yours. It's all about creativity and showing what someone else's take on the same thing. Like if you and I had the same footage and we edited a piece, it would be completely different. No. You know, music choices, everything is different. So no, it's not. Yes, there's competition. I believe there's competition, but oversaturated? No. I don't believe it's oversaturated. It's not easy to get in, but it's like anything nowadays. You got to work hard and you got to show that you're worthy to be in that club or be worthy to get a chance from that pro team. Oversaturated? No, not at all.
Yeah. My mentality is always like, you got to show them, like you got to offer them value. Like I just see so many kids coming in with the, you know, I've filmed for a year or so, whatever. Like now I want to make money from it. Like why I want everybody give me like an opportunity. But it's like, no one's going to hire you to help you. They're going to hire you to help themselves. So you got to give them a reason that, you know, whether it's like coming in for free for the first time just to show them your skills, or bringing them value that they're not getting from their current videographer, like looking at their content on their social media accounts, you can see what they're producing, show them what you're doing and how it's better than what they're doing, and I'll guarantee you they'll be interested. But if you're offering them the exact same thing that they're already doing, but you want to charge them money for it, it's like, why would they do that? So you need to offer something that they're after, like, or it's a different style, a different idea, a different concept, or just simply better. But they need you more than you need them, basically.
Listen, if you want to work in sports, act like an athlete, okay? athletes need to try out. Athletes need to get seen by scouts. Athletes need, you know? So put your stuff out there. Show them. That's why, even if you volunteered one day, here's the content. Look what I did. Look what I can do. Now, where can I take this? How can I help you solve your problem? It's the same thing. You know, they have to see you in order to give you that job. So just like an athlete, he has to be scouted or have a tryout to be on that team. Same concept.
I am an athlete.
Yeah. All right. So is that all for the questions today?
Yes. Today anyway. But feel free to send more questions our way.
Exactly. All right. So that is it for episode 2. Hopefully we covered enough gear for you guys. And like we said, if you had any questions, please add below in the social platforms. And we'll see you next week.
See ya.
Bye. Take care.